Chapter 52. Lift up a standard. Go through the gates. Prepare ye the way of the people. Cast up the highway. Gather out the stones. Lift up a standard for the people. Isaiah 1908. For several weeks, the Publishing House Building Fund notice in the Sentinel had said, quote, "As it is expected that the building will be finished early in July, there is but little time to spare in completing this fund." End quote. Mrs. Eddy wrote a very important letter early in July, July 3rd to be exact. The letter was handwritten to her publisher, Allison V. Stewart, and said, "I am impressed to write what must not be named before the debt of our publishing house is paid, and it is this. We should have a daily newspaper. It is very important to our cause, and the bulk of this cause demands it. I hereby state that so soon as said debt is paid, I will head a subscription list for this purpose with $100 subscribed, and I ask that you entitle the newspaper the Christian Science Monitor. Please keep silent on this matter till our church debts are paid. I want to name it to you and hear from you on this subject." It was exactly 2 months since she had written her first letter on this subject to Stewart and McClellan, and as with that letter of May 3rd, this one of July 3rd was not sent. A short editorial by Archibald McClellan in the Sentinel of July 4th began. Alleged early manuscripts. We have been asked about certain unpublished manuscripts said to have been written by Mrs. Eddy in the early years of her discovery of Christian Science. All we can say is that if these manuscripts are genuine, they are probably what she refers to in the preface of Science and Health. The rest of this article quoted from Science and Health. The last paragraph on page Roman numeral 8. And the last paragraph on page Roman numeral 9. There has been an interesting change in that second paragraph since this July 4th, 1908 editorial. What at that time said, quote, "These efforts show her ignorance," end quote, now says, quote, "her comparative ignorance," end quote. Immediately above McClellan's alleged early manuscripts is a take notice by Mary Baker Eddy, Miscellany, page 237, line 4, which begins, quote, "What I wrote on Christian Science some 25 years ago, I do not consider a precedent for a present student of this science," end quote. This statement has been used to turn students away from the earlier editions of Science and Health. But at the same time it was issued, she added the footnotes to miscellaneous writings, turning the students to the earlier editions. Her latest edition is most adapted to the thought of the age, so it should come first, that is, take precedence. But should it not also turn the student to an interest in the Revelator's footsteps and in her more incisive declarations? This notice ends, quote, "Hence it were wise to accept only my teachings that I know to be correct and adapted to the present demand," end quote. Did she write for that time only, or for all time? What is the present demand? Did the leader ever teach anything that she did not know to be correct? The story in Science and Health, page 184, line 27, of the woman she cured of consumption occurred in 1864, 2 years prior to her discovery of Christian Science. If her work at that time had not been correct, would she have left it in our textbook? The one thing she taught or allowed to her earliest students and very soon repudiated was Dr. Quimby's method of manipulation. This was, however, merely a crutch, as she told those students, and a procedure she never used. All of this took place prior to the first edition of Science and Health, in which she wrote, "Since witnessing the evil one student did in the name of science, we have utterly objected to students rubbing the head. We knew of no harm that could result from rubbing the head until we learned it of this malpractice, and never since have permitted a student with our consent to manipulate." Advanced students today who are not healing as they know they should be need to study the final chapter in the first edition of Science and Health, quote, "Healing the Sick," end quote. A letter written on July 2nd and published in the Sentinel of July 18th was a bit of history that no doubt thrilled the field and rejoiced the mother's heart. Leominster, Massachusetts, July 2nd, 1908. "Dear Leader, I had an uncle by marriage who was a helpless cripple and who was deformed. All his limbs were withered, and on very pleasant mornings a special policeman would wheel him out on Boston Common in his wheelchair. One morning, a number of years ago, he sat there in his wheelchair as you were passing through the common, and you stopped and spoke to him, telling him that man is God's perfect child, and a few other words. Later, after you had left him, he declared you had helped him. The next morning, he looked and looked for you in the same place, and morning after morning continued to do so, until one day you came. Again, you repeated to him what you had said before, and this time he was healed and made perfect, every whit whole. And after that, he was able to go into business for himself and provide his own living. No doubt you will remember the whole circumstance. His bones had hardened, so that when sitting or lying down, his knees were drawn up and rigid, his brother having to carry him up and down stairs and feed him and care for him all the time. But after he was healed through your spoken word, he was able to be as active as other men and earned his own living. And whereas before he could not even brush a fly from his face, he regained the use of his hands and became more than an ordinary penman. It was you, dear leader, who spoke to him of the healing Christ and set him free when you met him so long ago on Boston Common, and many times I have desired to tell you about it and to express to you my gratitude for the many benefits I also have received from Christian Science. Words can never express it. With deepest love, in which my husband joins me, your loving student, Mrs. Charlotte F. Lyon." All the students at Chestnut Hill, and particularly the new students, were learning a great deal every day in endeavoring to help the leader and to follow her instructions. One sentence in the first edition of Science and Health, page 370, gives a slight indication of what this teaching cost her. Quote, "Healing in science has its reward, even here, but the task of teaching the science of being is quite another thing." End quote. She also said, quote, "Those in health and at ease in their possessions are reluctant to change masters. Hence, the more thankless and toilsome task of teaching compared with healing." End quote. In a note to Calvin Fry on July 2nd, the leader said in part, "Beloved, if you knew with what I am beset continually, Mr. Dickey yields to malicious animal magnetism to such an extent, he affords me very little help in anything. I have to correct him continually." This was true of all the students, as well as Mr. Dickey, who recorded Mrs. Eddy's words to the students one day, quote, "Where all students have failed is in not knowing how to handle animal magnetism. If we don't break the belief that mesmerism has power, we are still the victims of mesmerism, and it is handling us. Now then, the main point is to keep your watch." End quote. Mr. Dickey had by this time learned a good deal about the importance of keeping watch and the work of the watchers. The one thing that none of them seemed to realize was that every student must learn to watch all of the time, quote, "that mental malpractice cannot harm you or your universe, either when asleep or when awake," end quote. Mrs. Eddy did this, and if her students had done more in this area, her work and suffering would have been lessened. But in 1908, she had to direct all their, quote, "watching," end quote, because in Mr. Dickey's words, quote, "she seemed to be the only one who was able to discern the course that error was pursuing," end quote. Chestnut Hill was truth's garrison in a world of sin and mental malpractice, and needed to be guarded at all times. The leader was doing her utmost to train these guards to watch, to detect the enemy's maneuvers, and to meet the attacks. 4 mental workers were each assigned 2-hour watches from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m., but the leader was always on guard. Adam Dickey wrote, "When a watch was kept, she always knew it, and the one keeping his watch was commended the next day. If the watch was not kept, and they were far more frequently not kept than kept, a corresponding rebuke was administered to the one who failed. What would an army have done to such soldiers who were on guard duty in time of war? Every advanced step Christian Science had made in this world had increased the intensity of the warfare the leader had first described many years earlier. The powers of evil are leagued together in secret conspiracy against the Lord and against his Christ, as expressed and operative in Christian Science. Large numbers in desperate malice are engaged day and night in organizing action against us. Their feeling and purpose are deadly, and they have sworn enmity against the lives of our standard bearers." There were many times when the mental workers at Chestnut Hill did meet some specific attack against their leader or her cause, but there were many more times when they did not. As a consequence, very often they were all called into the leader's study and admonished for their failure. The Sentinel for July 11th contained another new bylaw. Article 8. No monopoly. Section 30, Manual, page 49. It also contained this notice. Article 5 of the Church Bylaws, creating executive members, has been repealed. There being no further necessity for this organization, it is therefore disbanded. On the day that these two changes were published, Martha Wilcox left Chestnut Hill. She had received word of the death of her younger stepson and went immediately to Kansas City. A few days later, Mrs. Eddy suffered a very serious attack of intense pain and did not go out for her daily drive on Tuesday, July 14th. Calvin Fry said she was confined to her bed with little help from the mental workers. Evidently, in their failure to relieve her, some of them wanted her to call an MD, but Calvin records that she would not consent to this. Though she continued her work and her daily routine, she suffered a great deal for the next week or two. During this time, a letter she received caused her to send it and her answer to the Boston Transcript. Once again, her message is to all the world, as reprinted from the Transcript. A letter from Mrs. Eddy. Mrs. Mary Baker Eddy, leader of the Christian Science Movement, will hereafter abandon her much-talked-of daily drives, and instead will drive out only when her work makes no urgent demand on her time. This announcement comes through a response to a letter written to Mrs. Eddy by Mrs. Ella E. Williams, formerly second reader of the First Church of Christ Scientist in this city, and now a resident of Chestnut Hill. Mrs. Williams wrote as follows. Beloved leader, I have been pleased to see you drive out in your carriage every day. Also, to know that you can take time from your work to enjoy this daily drive. It brightens the day for me when I see you in your carriage. Very lovingly, your student, Ella E. Williams. Chestnut Hill, July 24th. In reply, Mrs. Eddy wrote, Box G, Brookline, Massachusetts, July 25th, 1908. Beloved student, I enjoy brightening your day, but the divine principle and not a personality should illumine the life of a Christian Scientist. Therefore, I repeat, turn your thought away from matter to spirit. I have so much that is of more importance to attend to than a daily drive that hereafter I shall go out only when the demands on my time at home are not imperative, and if I remain at home, I hope you will be influenced by a higher thought than a peep at my personality, and know that I love you. Mary Baker G. Eddy. In the first edition of Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy had written, Observation and experience teach us, those scorning to swerve from a direct line of duty, are vainly to stoop to personal aggrandizement at the sacrifice of conscience, and make popularity paramount to truth, are traduced by many whom that line of duty touches. The humanitarian is above the arrows in the quiver of ignorance, envy, or malice. They fly beneath his feet, until spent of their fury, they fall to the ground. The arrows of ignorance, envy, and malice had been aimed at the Revelator before she penned those words. In the 33 years since their publication, the arrows that had first been from the quiver of one malpractitioner had increased until the strongholds of all the evil on this earth were aiming their shafts at the Revelator. The students in her home who thought they were helping her knew very little about the evil they were battling. During one severe siege, she said to them, quote, "You don't any of you realize what is going on. This is a dark hour for the cause, and you do not seem to be awake to it. I am now working on a plane that would mean instantaneous death to any of you." End quote. The attacks of malice had kept Mrs. Eddy on the lounge in her study or in bed most of the time for nearly a week, until the evening of July 27th, when Calvin Fry said, quote, "She despaired of living until morning." End quote. It was almost midnight when the editor of the Boston Herald telephoned Mr. Dickey at Chestnut Hill and asked him at what hour Mrs. Eddy had died. He said that the rumor on the street was that Mrs. Eddy was dead. Suddenly, the practitioners in the home were able to see that this was attempted mental murder and were able to do some effective mental work. The very next morning, Mrs. Eddy sent this note to William B. Johnson. "Notice, so soon as the publishing house debt is paid, I request the Christian Science Board of Directors to start a daily newspaper called Christian Science Monitor. This must be done without fail. M.B.G. Eddy." It was probably that same day, July 28th, that she called Archibald McClellan to Chestnut Hill and told him that she wanted him to start a daily newspaper the next week. Adelaide Still said, "This was a bombshell. They had just finished paying for the publishing house and sent out a notification that no more money was needed. He told her they would have to get the tenants out of the buildings, take them down, and build an extension to the new publishing house, get correspondents all over the world, procure presses, etc." She said, quote, "Well, how soon can you do it?" End quote. So Mr. McClellan went back to Boston with plenty of work to do. On August 3rd, Mrs. Eddy sent some further instructions to her editor in these words, quote, "Have on the cover of the Christian Science Monitor, first the blade, then the ear. After that, the full corn in the ear. And have that illustrated with a pretty design." End quote. But she sensed that she did not have his wholehearted cooperation. 2 days later, on August 5th, she had Mr. Dickey write to her editor-in-chief. "Dear Mr. McClellan, our leader wishes you would have some thoroughly responsible outside person write an article to the Sentinel setting forth Mrs. Eddy's unexampled leadership in the interests of Christian Science. Let the article be entitled Competence, and have it point out the fact that from the inception of this movement until the present time, not one false step had marred the long line of successful efforts put forth by her in support of her religion. From the time when stones were thrown through the windows and church doors were closed against her, until today, when Christian Science churches are encircling the globe, the wisdom of her every act has been abundantly sustained by the complete success that had followed every new move she has made. No special attention need be given to the above wording, the object being to impress thought with our leader's unerring wisdom and entire competency in every branch of life's work she has undertaken. Let the article be strong and carry with it complete conviction as to her ability to lead under divine guidance. Sincerely yours, Adam H. Dickey. The object, of course, was to impress Mr. McClellan's thought, quote, with our leader's unerring wisdom and entire competency, end quote. And the leader's next step in leavening the thought of her editor was a second letter to him from Mr. Dickey later that same day. Since writing the attached letter, our leader has thought it would be better to have you write the article referred to as an editorial, for as she stated, no one is more competent to do this than you. She further said that the article should make it clear that every move that has been made in the line of demonstration for the cause of Christian Science has originated with her. You will understand that the article is preparatory to making public her intention of starting a daily newspaper. Mrs. Eddy does not care whether it appears in this week's Sentinel or next. She allowed McClellan 2 days for preparing this strong editorial on her competency, quote, preparatory to making public her intention of starting a daily newspaper, end quote. Then, on August 7th, she had Calvin Fry write to him, Dear Bro McClellan, Mother says do not publish that article on competence in this week's Sentinel. While this was going on, the directors were hedging and discussing the situation. They felt that the trustees were the ones to undertake this project and suggested that an order should go to them from Mrs. Eddy. So the leader complied with this letter of August 8th to the Christian Science Board of Trustees, which she entrusted to Mr. McClellan to deliver to them. Beloved students, it is my request that you start a daily newspaper at once and call it the Christian Science Monitor. Let there be no delay. The cause demands that it be issued now. You may consult with the Board of Directors. I have notified them of my intention. Lovingly yours, Mary B. G. Eddy. The trustees had just begun to relax after working for nearly a year on the new publishing house. The Sentinel of August 8th announced, quote, the publishing house building fund completed, end quote. It also stated, quote, it is expected that the Sentinel of August 15th will be issued from the new building, end quote. On August 4th, after the foregoing announcement was assured, Trustee McKenzie and his wife had left Boston for a vacation on the summer farm of the Metcalfs in Dublin, New Hampshire. The directors had kept Mrs. Eddy's new project to themselves for 10 days. But on August 9th, Mr. McKenzie received a telegram saying business of great importance had arisen and to take the first train to Boston. At 4 o'clock the next morning, he walked 3 miles to flag down the first train and was in Boston for a meeting of the trustees at 10:30 a.m. on August 10th, at which meeting Mr. McClellan delivered Mrs. Eddy's letter to them. Their work began from that moment. Trustees and directors met the next morning and recorded in their minutes, quote, it was agreed between the two boards that the directors are charged with the duty of providing the building or place for the publication of the Monitor, and that the trustees are charged with the duty of organizing and starting the new paper, end quote. The same day the trustees wrote Mrs. Eddy, your letter of August 8th was delivered to us yesterday. As soon as we received your letter, we immediately began the work of starting the new daily, and we shall proceed with it without delay. Today we consulted with the Board of Directors. Tomorrow and next day we will confer with two practical newspaper men from Pittsburgh and Chicago, whom Mr. McClellan has called here as advisors. 2 days later, the trustees sent the leader a lengthy, detailed letter outlining requirements and expenses. The following day, August 14th, Adam Dickey sent this response. Your letter of the 13th instant addressed to Mrs. Eddy, comprising the report of your plans for starting a Christian Science daily paper, is at hand. After reading this report, our leader expressed surprise at the amount of capital that would be required. Her original thought on the subject was that you should proceed to get out a small paper of about 8 pages and with a circulation of about 50,000 or 60,000 copies at a much less outlay than the amount stated in your letter. Her intention was not to branch out at once into metropolitan greatness, but rather to begin in a comparatively small way and grow into bigger things with the progress of time. However, she does not wish to hamper your movements by placing restrictions on the amount you shall spend, but wishes you to go ahead with wisdom and economy as your guides. Our leader hopes you will not find it necessary to consult with her with regard to details, but proceed with the work in your own way, doing the best you can. Mrs. Eddy was exceedingly interested in the issuance of the Christian Science Monitor, but there was one great departure in this new venture. In every other forward step, she had encouraged her lieutenants to make decisions, but had watched every detail most carefully and usually had to make all the decisions herself, oftentimes reversing theirs. This time, she was leaving the details and the decisions to her trustees and directors, with the instruction through Mr. Dickey to, quote, proceed with the work in your own way, doing the best you can, end quote. Many people have mentioned that Mrs. Eddy was always interested in new inventions. Martha Wilcox said that all the rooms at Chestnut Hill were carpeted and had to be cleaned with brooms until the vacuum cleaner was manufactured, when they had one of the first ones. Mrs. Eddy loved her horses and carriage, but Calvin Fry recorded early in August that, quote, Mrs. Eddy took a half hour's ride in her limousine today, end quote. Calvin also recorded on August 16th, quote, today completes 26 years continuous service in Mrs. Eddy's employ, end quote. The workers in Mrs. Eddy's home were learning more about Christian Science than any others in the world, and she offered this sacred privilege to a great many. Few, however, were capable of receiving this training. Some of those few at Chestnut Hill were Mrs. Minnie Scott, Mrs. Minnie McDonald, Victoria Sargent's daughter, and Mrs. Ella Hogue of Toledo, Ohio. Mrs. Minnie Scott was at Chestnut Hill in the summer of 1908 and was Mrs. Eddy's maid for a time, as Martha Wilcox had been. On August 10th, Calvin Fry recorded in his diary that Mrs. Scott's niece had been playing with some Roman Catholic children, and one of them had said that old Mrs. Eddy has got to die, and there are 60 bishops praying for it. Mrs. Eddy said one day to her maid, Minnie, if you knew that someone was trying to get into your home to bother you, would you just know that love was your protection and that no harm could come to you? Mrs. Scott answered, yes, Mother, that is what I would know. but at the same time, I would see to it that the doors and windows were all tightly locked. Mrs. Eddy replied, "There, you have given me both the spirit and the letter, and there is nothing more to be said." Her mental workers, too, needed strengthening. Adam Dickey recorded this watch on August 16th. Quote, "There is no psychology and no Roman Catholic prayers frightening us in this house. There is no sin and no fear of sin. Christian Scientists love the psychologists and the Roman Catholics, and they love us. Good is all power and the only power." End quote. Again and again in her talks to her students, the leader quoted Jesus' words, quote, "Could ye not watch with me 1 hour?" End quote. And oft she quoted his words in Matthew 24, quote, "If the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched." End quote. One morning after she had talked with them at length, admonished them, and dismissed them to do their work, she called them back and said, "Now, what is the great necessity I have been impressing on you?" Mr. Dickey replied, "Demonstration." Several others gave other answers, and she said, "No, you are all wrong. You have missed the importance of the lesson I have just given you. I felt it and called you back to show you your ignorance. The lesson is this: keep your watch." Once again, they were dismissed, but very shortly she called them back once more. This time she said, "What I have to meet, you will all have to meet, now or again. Therefore, know that the mesmerist cannot afflict either you or me with erroneous beliefs. If you will keep your watch, I shall be a well woman. If you stay here until you learn to handle animal magnetism, I will make healers out of you. I had to do it and did it for 40 years, and you must do it. You must rise to the point where you can destroy the belief in mesmerism, or you will have no cause. It tried to overcome me for 40 years, and I withstood it all. Now it has gotten to the point where the students must take up this work and meet animal magnetism. I cannot do it for you. You must do it for yourselves. And unless it is done, the cause will perish, and we will go along another 1900 years with the world sunk into the blackest night. Now, will you rouse yourselves? You have all the power of God with you to conquer this lie of mesmerism. The workers in the field are not healing because they are not meeting animal magnetism, which says they cannot heal." Then the leader asked each in turn, "Will you keep your watch?" After each had answered in the affirmative, she said, "To keep your watch doesn't only mean to be awake at that hour and to be working mentally. It means to do the work and succeed in breaking the mesmerism for the 2 hours assigned. If you don't succeed, you haven't kept your watch." The look the leader gave to Mr. Dickey and the extra pressure she gave to his hand as she held it in both of hers when he promised to keep his watch caused him to redouble his efforts. She followed this promise with a further assignment to Adam Dickey, that students of the future may learn from his record what is to be met, and how to meet it. Most often, when Mrs. Eddy returned from her daily drive, she would lie down to rest for an hour before beginning the afternoon's work, usually resting on the lounge in her study. On the afternoon of Tuesday, August 25th, she was still lying there when she summoned Mr. Dickey. When he arrived, she requested the three students who were present, Calvin Fry, Laura Sargent, and probably Adelaide Still, to leave the room. Then, according to Mr. Dickey, she beckoned me to approach. She extended her hand to me, took mine in both of hers, and asked in a deep, earnest voice, "Mr. Dickey, I want you to promise me something. Will you?" I said, "Yes, Mother, I certainly will." "Well," she continued, "if I should ever leave here, do you know what I mean by that?" "Yes, Mother." "If I should ever leave here," she repeated, "will you promise me that you will write a history of what has transpired in your experiences with me, and say that I was mentally murdered?" I answered, "Yes, Mother, I will." "Now, Mr. Dickey, do not let anything interfere with your keeping this promise. Will you swear to me before God that you will not fail to carry out my wish?" I raised my right hand and said, "Mother, I swear before God that I will do what you request of me, namely, write a history of what I have seen and heard from your lips concerning your life." "That will do, dear. I know now that you will not fail me." Her whole demeanor was one of solemn intensity, and there was an eagerness in her voice and manner such as I seldom saw. I returned to my room and pondered deeply over what she had said. In a few minutes, one of the workers and Mrs. Sargent brought me a sealed envelope. In it was a penciled note reiterating the statement that she had made in our conversation of a short time before. Mrs. Eddy knew on that summer afternoon that she would soon be leaving them. But Mr. Dickey had no idea in August of 1908 how difficult an assignment it was to, quote, "not let anything interfere with your keeping this promise," end quote. Because, quote, "the powers of evil are leagued together in secret conspiracy against the Lord and against his Christ as expressed and operative in Christian Science," end quote. Everything interfered with his fulfilling this obligation after the leader was mentally murdered. It took Mr. Dickey 14 years to break the mesmerism and keep his promise. Before the end of August, Mrs. Eddy had Mr. Dickey write a letter of great import to all the field for all time, though he did not realize its importance at that time. It was also a thrilling letter for Mr. Gaspard of East Aurora, New York, to receive, as is evident from his response on August 29th. "Beloved leader, through Mr. Dickey, I have just received notice of your favorable judgment of my drawing and the request for permission to use the portrait in Science and Health. Surely this is a splendid crown for my effort, and I am at a loss how to express my satisfaction in this unlooked-for result of my work. Although the drawing was not made with this end in view, you have recognized in it a labor of love. The desire and purpose to make as good a portrait as I could have indeed been mine ever since my recognition of the truth and beauty of Christian Science and of its bounty and benefit to me, so that in a small measure at least, this drawing testifies to my gratitude and love. Devotedly yours, Jules Maurice Gaspard.